This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We start with chapter 15 this evening. We'll only be doing the first section of chapter 15. I'm going to read through the first few verses with you. Vayomer Shmuel el Shaul. And Shmuel said to Shaul, Osi sholach Hashem limshoch achol melech al amoy al Yisrael. God sent me to anoint you as the king over his people, over Israel. V'yato, and now, Shema l'kol divrei Hashem. Listen to the voice of the words of God. Notice the wording. It's not just Shema, not just listen to the voice of God or listen to the words of God. It's listen to the voice of the words of God. Too often we hear the words and we don't hear the voice, or we hear the voice but we don't hear the words. That applies both in human communication and in our communication with God. The words tell us a certain amount, but the voice tells us a whole lot more about what the true meaning is of those words, what the true intent is of those words. Words can mean all sorts of different things, and they depend not only on the context in which they're used, but also the tone of voice with which they're used, the dramatic accompaniment with which it's used. And in listening to God too, Shmuel warns Shaul to listen not only to the voice of God, not only to the words of God, but also to the voice of God, implying, as Rashi points out, that you messed up once already. Listen carefully this time. Ko amar Hashem Tzvois, so said God, Pakadati es asher oso Amalek liYisrael. I have taken account of what Amalek did to the Jewish people. Asher som loy baderech ba'aloysoy mimitzroyim. That which he did to them when they came up out of Egypt. So all of a sudden now God's looking back centuries in history, saying, I'm aware of, I've taken account of what the Amalekites did. And as a result of what they did at that time to the Jews on their way out from Egypt, Atah now, lech vihikiso es Amalek, go and smite Amalek. They're not threatening you in any way, they haven't picked a fight with you. You go out aggressively to them and smite them. Bahacharamtem es kol asher lo. You shall destroy everything that they possess. You shall show them no mercy. You are to kill from man to woman, from child to infant, ox and lamb, the non-kosher animals too, camels and donkeys. They are to be utterly and totally eradicated. Let's stop there for a moment, because we need to understand what this is. This is an unadulterated case of genocide. This is not a military encounter. This is not self-defense. This is an out-and-out case of genocide. God is instructing the Jewish people to annihilate a nation. To annihilate a nation that did something a few centuries ago. Did something horrible a few centuries ago. But to annihilate the men, the women, the children, the babies, the cattle, the animals, everything. There should be no remnant of this nation whatever. This is the only time we have this. In every other occasion where God instructs the Jewish people to go to war, he instructs them first to offer the option of peace. Never do we go out to war without offering the option of peace, except with the Amalekite people. where there is an obligation, this in fact is a mitzvah, stated in the Torah to wipe out the Amalekite people. And this mitzvah theoretically applies today as well. If we knew for sure who the Amalekite people were, we would have to wipe them out. That would be a mitzvah. So imagine, you know, people say they're ready for Mashiach to come, and so if Mashiach came and said the Amalekites are the Germans, or the Amalekites are the Russians, or the Amalekites are the Japanese, and you've got a very nice Japanese or Russian or German neighbor, you would have to quietly in the middle of the night take out your shotgun and go next door and wipe them out. That's what you would have to do. Are we ready for that? Do we understand that? Are we willing to deal with that? And yes, we could gloss over this and kind of pretend it doesn't exist, but this is a part of our religion. This is one of the mitzvahs. This is one of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah, to wipe out Amalek. And it's not a theoretical mitzvah. It's theoretical today for one reason only, and that is we don't know who the Amalekite people are. And because they're all intermarried and they're all over the place and we can't sort them out. But it's not theoretical in principle. It's as practical as any other mitzvah of the Torah. Why would a God of mercy and a God of love, a Father, the creator of all mankind, why would he instruct us to totally annihilate a nation that did something bad hundreds of years ago and nowadays thousands of years ago? And if it was an action they did bad, if they performed a really bad thing, then we have that Gemara in Brochus where Rabbi Meir was having a rough time. He was a rabbi, and rabbis have very hard times. And sometimes they have, not often, but it can happen, that they have hostile committees and hostile presidents and hostile chairmen. And the Rabbi Meir was no exception. He was suffering. He was really made to suffer by some very powerful members of his community. They degraded him and they made his life very, very difficult. So he thought, well, no problem. I've got a direct line to God. I'll annihilate them. So I'm not going to get involved in this kind of petty nonsense. So after davening one morning, he said, and by the way, God, just wipe those guys out for me. It's enough already. I've tried, I've talked to them, there's nothing I can do with them. Why don't you wipe them out? His wife, Bruria, overheard him davening and said, Rabbi Meir, excuse me, what was that you said? And he said, well, you know that these are wicked people. You know they're undermining my efforts and everything that we're trying to do. You know that they're out to destroy and to be negative in every way possible. They hate God, they hate the Torah, they hate me. So I asked God to annihilate them. What's so wrong with that? She says, oh no. It says in the Torah, in Tehillim, Yitomu chatoim min ha'oretz. You are permitted to pray that sinners disappear from the world. And then, that sin disappears from the world, and then Urushoyim Oid Einam, after that there will be no wicked people. If there is no sin, there will be no wicked people. I was talking to a team of Los Angeles policemen today, and they said to me, no, they disagree with that Gemara. Get rid of the people and there'll be no sin. Get rid of the crime, get rid of the people and there'll be no crime. The Gemara doesn't say that. The Gemara says get rid of the crime and there'll be no sin. Get rid of the wrongdoing. Get rid of the immorality. Get rid of the lack of ethic. And then there won't be criminals. So if you want to pray to God, ask God to eliminate the negative in the personality. Not to eliminate the personality. Not to destroy the person. Destroy the action. And then the person will no longer be a rosha. He'll no longer be wicked. And you'll have no problem with him. And Rabbi Meir accepted it. So in the case of Amalek, how would Bruria deal with this? Why does God say destroy the Amalekites? Why doesn't God just destroy the wrongdoing of the Amalekite people and leave them alone? Why doesn't he teach them a lesson? Why doesn't he communicate with them? Why doesn't he threaten them? Why doesn't he bring a few earthquakes and tidal waves and things to shake them up a little bit? And then send a prophet like Jonah to say, look, that's just a little warning. You want to see the real stuff? Carry on doing what you're doing. And surely they would have repented, they would have changed. Why does God instruct the Jewish nation, who is not a warlike nation at all, not a naturally aggressive people, to utterly destroy an entire nation? And if you'll say it's because it's not the wrongdoing, it's a character trait that is so negative that they're never going to change that. Well, there are lots of nations with bad character traits. What does God do with Moab, and what does he do with Ammon, and what does he do with Mitzrayim? There are lots of nations with bad character traits. What does God do? He says, don't marry them. No converts. Keep them separate. Genetic purity. Genetic purity doesn't mean genocide. Genetic purity means we won't marry them. That's all. That's, of course, the whole argument in Bosnia and Serbia. You want to remain separate. That's okay. Nothing wrong with that. You don't want to intermarry with one another. That's fine. No problem. Don't kill each other. If you want to preserve your genetic purity, don't intermarry. That's all. The solution to genetic impurity is not genocide. So it can't be that there's a character flaw that God is upset about. So what is it that the Amalekite people did that was so terrible that God wants them annihilated, the entire nation? What did they do? When the Jewish people were coming out of Egypt, they were the first nation that attacked them, and they attacked them in quite a sly way. They attacked their women and children. They attacked from behind. They got the stragglers, the people who weren't able to keep up. They got the people who were weak, people who were morally weak, the people who were physically weak, and they destroyed those people. That's what the Amalekites did. Not very nice. It's not a gentlemanly thing to do in war. But is that a reason to annihilate them? And this instruction to Shaul is the downfall of Shaul. So we're dealing with a very critical moment in Jewish history, where Shaul is charged with a job that is almost beyond his character, almost beyond his personality, not totally beyond his personality. He could have done it. God doesn't give any of us a task that we can't do. He could have done it, but it was a tough one. It was one that went against every fabric of his very being. So we need to understand what this is, and I'm going to spend most of this evening shir analyzing with you what the Amalekite nation is that makes it so worthy of nothing but destruction, that is totally beyond any kind of repairs, totally beyond any kind of reformation, totally beyond any kind of change, that it is possible for the human being or for a human race to get to a point where it cannot change. It is possible for people, for an organization, to get to a point where it cannot change. What is that point? What determines that point? And why can it not change? Now, one of the interesting things about Amalek, and we'll see it later on here again, is that this event that I referred to, this war between Amalek and the Jewish people, took place, or is reported in the Torah, at the end of Parshas Beshalach, just before the beginning of Parshas Yisro. So the last episode of the Sedra of Beshalach is the war with the Amalekites, and then the next paragraph opens with Yisro. Yisro, you remember, was a non-Jewish person whose daughter married Moshe and who converted to Judaism and molded the judicial system that we have followed since then. Not only have we followed, but in fact he molded the judicial system that exists in all Judeo-Christian countries till this day. The judicial system that we follow in this country and in all civilized countries today was an outcome of the thinking of Yisro, a non-Jewish character who occupies a central role in the Torah. And he is introduced into the Torah right after, or is introduced in this major sense, is introduced in a minor sense in the interaction with Moshe, which we're going to refer to a little bit later on this evening. But his major introduction to center stage Torah is right after the Amalekite War. And the Medrash notices this juxtaposition and makes the following comment. It quotes a verse from Mishlei, from the book of Proverbs, written by King Solomon. Late takeh Ufesi Ya'arim. Smite a cynic, and the wise person will learn. Explains the Medrash. Another similar verse, also from the book of Proverbs, is Be'enosh Leitz Yech Kampesi. Almost an identical verse. So King Solomon says it twice. By punishing a cynic, the wise person will learn. Amolek v'Yisroi hoyu be'etzo im Paro. Says the Medrash, Amolek and Yisroi were part of Paro's cabinet when he was deciding what to do about the Jewish problem. Keshero Yisroi she'ovad HaKadosh Baruch Hu es Amolek min ha'ilom hazeh min ha'ilom habo. When Yisroi saw what happened to Amalek, that he attacked the Jewish people later on, and that God then said, that's it, kill these people, wipe them out. They have no part in this world and no part in the world to come. Tohe, he thought about it, he was astonished, v'osa teshuva, and he repented and converted and became part of the Jewish nation. What's important in this sentence is that you can't punish, or that in punishing a leitz, a cynic, it doesn't say the cynic will learn. The purpose of punishing the cynic is not for his education. He is not educatable. The purpose of punishing the cynic is because of the impact that's going to have on other people. If you don't punish the cynic, society will be affected badly. But don't think that by punishing the cynic or trying to educate him, he's going to change. So this concept of leitz, which I've just chosen to define or to translate as the cynic, this concept of the leitz is identified as Amalek's characteristic, and we need to analyze what this leitz means and why it's uneducatable. In doing that, there is a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says, Kol leitzanuso asiro, one is not permitted to be cynical, with one exception. See, leitz isn't just cynical. Leitz is a bit of a clowning, mocking, undermining. That's all. It has that kind of meaning. But cynic is probably the closest translation. One may be cynical about nothing, excepting one issue, and that's avodah zarah, idol worship. That's what the Gemara says. It's the only thing we're allowed to be cynical about. We're allowed to laugh about, joke about. Can't joke about other things. You can't undermine people's beliefs, even if you don't share them. You can't be cynical about them. You can't undermine them. But idolatry you can. That you can just laugh at. So there's nothing wrong with that. Why? Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner, a deep, deep Torah thinker who died only recently, explains that, and he explains it based on a statement of Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah lived in the Middle Ages, a very important authority in a number of areas, and one of them the whole ethical and philosophical area of Torah. And I'm going to read you the relevant part of Rabbeinu Yonah. He bases this on yet another verse of Proverbs. There's great wisdom in King Solomon's Proverbs in Sefer Mishlei. Metzaref lechesef v'chur lezohav. The goldsmith knows how to evaluate the purity of silver and of gold. The ish, and how do you evaluate the nobility or the refinement of a human being? Who does that? Says King Solomon, Lefi Mahalaloi, according to his praise. Now, politicians in the United States and other countries in the Western world understand that to mean that if a person is popular, he must be good. That's what King Solomon says. Ish lefi mahalaloi, a man by the way he's praised. And that's why if you go to a wedding, people get up and what do? They praise one another, they praise the balei simcha, they talk about them, it makes everybody feel happy, because people think that King Solomon says that that determines that you're a good person. If everybody gets up and drinks a toast to you and says what a wonderful person you are, you must be a wonderful person. But says Rabbeinu Yonah, that's not what King Solomon means at all. He means the following. Perusho, that means. Ma'alois ha'odom, the quality of a person is reflected lefi ma'ashi yehalel, on the basis of who and what he praises. Don't listen to what they say about him. listen to what he says about them. That's where you determine the quality. Who does he admire? Who does he praise? Im hu mishabeach hamasim hatovim, if he praises good deeds, v'hachachomim, he praises wisdom, v'tzadikim, he praises noble and righteous people, teido uvachanto, you may know, says Rabbeinu Yonah, this is good authority, you may know, for you have tested, ki ish tov, that he is a good man. You don't have to know anymore. Just listen, who does he criticize and who does he praise? What does he criticize and what does he praise? If he's constantly praising good things, he's a good person. Mibli, and he goes on to say, Ve'im yitachen ki yesh biyodo avonos nistorim. He might have sinned, that doesn't mean he's never sinned. It doesn't mean he's an angel. He might have sinned. Aval me'ohave hatzedek hu, but he is a lover of righteousness. He is one of those that are called the glorifiers of God, those who honor God, and that's a very high status in the hierarchy that he describes. And if a person praises bad deeds and wicked people, hu harosho hagomu, that is an absolute evil man. You can know that. You don't have to see him in action. You only have to see and hear who and what he praises. That means, says the way Rabbi Yitzchak Hutner explains that, he does it even more graphically than that, and says you can imagine two people. One of them Yitachen yisesh lefaneinu shnei bnei odom. Imagine, says Rabbi Yitzchak Hutner, you could have two people before you. Ha'echod oisek batoiro bishkedo uvahasmodo. One deals with Torah, he studies 24 hours a day. Vasheni enenu klal begedizeh shel oisek batoiro. The other one is hardly ever learning. Avaluma zois, but on the other hand, moitzimano etzarishon tnuis shel hisbatlus b'shor shenichnas elav oshir godo. When a millionaire walks in, the one who learns Torah all day, you can see he's impressed. Stands up, greets him warmly. You can see it's impressive, irrespective of what kind of man that millionaire is. But if a wise person comes in, a brilliant person comes in, ein hu zaz mim koimu, he doesn't move, doesn't acknowledge him. But the other one who's never learning, when he meets a wise person, you see him honoring, you see him submitting himself to the superiority of the wisdom of the person he's honoring. Whereas when a wealthy person comes in, if he's a stupid wealthy person, it doesn't impress him. He's unaffected by it. In such a case, Rabbeinu Yonah says to us, from the point of view of learning, the first one's on a higher level than the second. Listen to those words. But the first one, that fellow who learns all day, is much further from the Torah than the second one. Don't measure proximity to the Torah just by the hours of learning or the amount of observance. That's not how you measure it. You're measuring a value system, and the way you'll measure the value system is by who he honors and who he recognizes. That's what really tells you who he gets excited by, who he wants to be close to, who he wants to elevate. That tells you who the person really is. That's where you determine the quality and the nobility of individuals. Let's take that idea a little further. We have two very closely related words. Rabbi Yitzchak Hutner comes onto it later on, in fact. The one is halal and the one is halal. Neither of them mean food that a Muslim may eat. Halal means praise, celebrate. Halal means an empty space. What is Avodah Zorah? Avodah, service, religious service, is the highest form of honor one can possibly give anything. Religious service is complete acknowledgement, complete submission before a higher power. That's what avodah is. Avodah is I make myself an eved, I enslave myself to a higher force. So avodah is celebration of the most ultimate form. What is idolatry? The celebration of nothing. To find sacredness in meaninglessness. That's idolatry. That's worthy of leitzonus. That you can be cynical about. Because what is the cynic? The cynic is the person who finds nothing in meaning, rather than meaning in nothing. Exactly the opposite of the idolater. The idolater finds meaning in nothingness. The leitz, the cynic, finds nothingness in meaning. And therefore the only way to deal with idolatry, to counteract the effect of idolatry, is with leitzonus. You've got to laugh it off. You've got to reveal the absolute nothingness in it. The absolute emptiness. The fact that all it is the creation of an aura around nothing. And that can, to explode that myth, the only way you can explode that myth is with cynicism. With jocularity, with complete bittul, complete denial of any kind of worth or value. It's interesting, in that area of worth and value, and in the area of avodah zarah, physical things are evaluated in terms of their quantitative measures. How much? Volume. Mass. Weight. Spiritual things are evaluated in terms of their capacity to impact. That's how you measure how powerful a spiritual force is. And energy, of course, is measured the same way. Energy is measured in how much water and a unit of energy can heat. Isn't that how these calories and kilojoules and things are worked out? It's how much it can do. Not how much is there. That's not important. You can have one little atom. It can affect a lot. It can do a lot. When you're measuring energy, you measure its impact. You don't measure its volume. Its volume is irrelevant. What's important is its impact. How much heat can it produce? This we find in the laws of Shabbat. For example, if in the laws of cooking on Shabbat, if you have a kli rishon means you've taken a pot off the fire, but this is a pot that actually stood on the fire, on the stove, and it's now at 70 degrees centigrade. Are you allowed to pour it over something uncooked? No, can't do that. You can't put something uncooked into it. It's a kli rishon because you are cooking by doing that. However, a kli sheni, this is now something you've poured out. You've taken the pot off the stove and you've poured it into a second pot. And let us say, in fact, you go further and you pour it from the second pot into a third pot. But its temperature is still 80 degrees. Can you pour that over something uncooked? Yes, you can. Because the measure is not how hot it is. The measure is its capacity to transfer that heat and cook a new object. And apparently, a kli rishon has a power to cook more potent than a kli sheni, irrespective of its temperature. I'm using that as a halakhic example of the principle that when you're measuring energy, you measure its ability to impact, not its quantitative measure, not its temperature, but its power to cook, its power to affect other. Spirituality is measured in terms of its power to impact. The objects of idolatry, whether it's beauty, sometimes people worship beauty. Sometimes people worship a mountain. Sometimes people worship an idol. What is its power to impact? Zero. There's volume. Sometimes it's big and magnificent and costs a lot. It's a gold idol. So they're worshipping quantity. They're not worshipping capacity to impact. That defines idolatry. When people get impressed with quantitative issues, irrespective of their capacity to impact, they're in the idolatry field. when people are attracted to capacity to impact rather than volume, they're into the spiritual field. How much volume does God have? How much does he weigh? Nothing. What is his mass? Nothing. What is his temperature? Doesn't have one. What is his capacity to impact? Infinite. Therefore, he's God. There's almost an inverse proportion between the amount of volume and the capacity to impact when you're dealing with energy. And therefore, Avodah Zorah, idolatry, is the celebrating the sacredness of nothing. Whereas the service of God is finding and celebrating the sacredness of everything. There's a big difference between that. So if we put it that way, then idolatry is the process of chilul, or leitzonus. Let's take cynicism, is chilul, is finding the nothingness in everything. And it's not difficult to find the nothingness in everything. You can say a human being is nothing more than, I don't know what it is, it's mostly water and a few molecules of DNA, and that's about it. That's what a human being is. You can say a Rembrandt is nothing more than a few ounces of paint on a canvas. You can say that an atom is nothing more than a tiny little atom, a little something you can't even see. One can reduce anything, no matter how powerful, to nothing if you focus on the nothingness of it. Because everything has nothingness, even God. How much volume? None. How much mass? None. How much temperature? None. If you want to seek the nothingness in everything, you'll find the nothingness in everything. But if you want to seek the everything in things, if you want to seek the sacredness in things, you can do that too, except in one thing, to find sacredness in nothing. And idolatry does that. It finds sacredness in nothing. It finds sacredness in impotence. It finds sacredness in things that have no power, in things that have no capacity to impact. That's idolatry. From understanding idolatry and cynicism, or understanding idolatry, we can understand cynicism. So cynicism is now finding the nothingness in everything. Can you educate a cynic? He will devalue everything. It's nothing but. And no matter what lesson you try to teach him, and no matter what life experience he has, no matter what he goes through in his existence, he will reduce it to the lowest possible level of interpretation. There's no way he's going to learn from that. There's no way he's going to gain anything from that. The cynic, by very definition, is incapable of change. Because for change, you've got to identify impact. For change, you've got to realize that something happened. For change, you've got to realize that something more could happen. For change, you've got to realize my potential to impact. And that my potential to impact could be doubled if I change. But the cynic doesn't deal with impact. The cynic deals with volume. The cynic deals with measurables. The cynic will always look at what undermines the very essence of it. Einstein could have come to a cynic with his theory of relativity, and the cynic would have said, "And how much can you earn with it? How much is it worth?" Wouldn't have been able to do anything about that. We were once in touring in France, the beautiful Versailles Palace, and just seeing one work of art after the other, one priceless work of art after the other, one priceless piece of furniture after another, till your eyes just start, you don't know what to do eventually. Another room, and each room is just incalculable value and incalculable beauty and history and tradition and culture. And at the end of the tour, there was a French lady who was taking this group around. There were people from all over the world on this group. There's one fellow from the United States. He says, "Tell me, how much does this place cost?" She said, "Excuse me?" He said, "How much does it cost, all of this?" She said, "It's not for sale." He said, I'm not making you an offer. I just want to know, if it were for sale, how much would you want for it? And she just looked completely blankly at him. And then I explained to her that he has no other way of evaluating. He doesn't know how to evaluate other than by the price tag. That's all he knows. You hear how often people will tell you in business, they don't buy a particular thing, or people are trying to sell them, they say, it's not selling. You say, why isn't it selling? It's just too cheap. People aren't able to discern value other than by something quantifiable. And the easiest thing to quantify is the price. If it's expensive, it's probably good. And if it's cheap, what's wrong with it? They've lost the inner capacity to relate directly and intuitively and evaluate something and say, I like this, I'm willing to pay for it. To me, it's valuable. I don't care what other people value it at. To me, it's valuable. I'm willing to invest in that. People have lost that capacity. Because we like to use one common denominator to evaluate everything. And it doesn't work like that. The way you evaluate music and a slab of cheese, different ways. You know, you can't use a scale to evaluate the music. The way you measure the heat of a cup of tea is different to the way you measure the distance from here to San Francisco. You can't use a thermometer to measure distance. Every experience and every object has a different way of measuring its value. And spiritual things are measured by their capacity to impact, not by how much there is of it. When one measures only by how much there isn't the capacity for change. There isn't the capacity to realize that without changing my volume or my matter, my mass, I could change my impact. The cynic believes, I am what I am. Can't change me. That's how I was created. What am I going to do? Change? I can't change. You can't change features. And you will hear you can change features as well, I suppose. But you can't meaningfully change features. You can't change the givens, the measurables. That God's given you. That God dishes out to you. What do we have on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? What do we pray for? All the measurables. Health, wealth, all the measurables that God decides. What we choose to do with those measurables. How we choose to impact with them. How we choose to invest and apply them. And what the results of that investment is, that God doesn't determine. That's entirely up to us. But the cynic doesn't accept that. And therefore the cynic won't accept the challenge of change, not realizing that that's even a possibility. Let's get to Amalek and Yisro. Yisro realizes the possibilities and the challenges. What's our first introduction to Yisro? You'll remember Moshe is running away from Egypt because he killed somebody. He comes to the well. Yisro's daughters are there. He helps them. He saves them from drowning. And they thank him very much and they go home. And their father says, you're quicker than normal today. And they said, yes, it was an Egyptian there who helped us. He said, what do you mean it's an Egyptian there who helped us? Why don't you invite him in? Did you just leave him there? And he sends them back to go and find Moshe and invite him for a meal. That meal had great significance, as we'll see in our own chapter now. But apart from the significance it has in our chapter, of course, that was where Moshe and Zipporah met. That's where the Shidduch was made. It's where Moshe met his wife and where Yisro's daughter met her husband and where Yisro met his future son-in-law by that act of kindness. Yisro wasn't prepared to let an opportunity go. He wasn't prepared to let an experience in life pass. He wasn't prepared to let the opportunity for engaging with somebody new, somebody different. Maybe this will change us. Maybe this will impact on us. Maybe we'll impact on him. He saw potential. He saw possibility. What do you mean there was an Egyptian man who had enough in him to help you and you don't invite him in? Let's speak to him. Let's find out who he is. Let's experience him. Let's enjoy him. How can you leave him there? And he sends her back. That's not a cynic. In fact, when Yisro heard what happened to Amalek, Yisro changes. When Yisro hears what happens to Amalek, Yisro evolves and he develops and he changes himself and he becomes more spiritual and he becomes more learned and he becomes more creative and he makes this enormous contribution to humanity, never mind to the Jewish people. When Bilam refers to the Jewish people, to the Amalekite people, he says, Rashis Goyim Amalek. Amalek is the first of the nations. V'acharisoi Adei Oved. And the ultimate of him is going to be distraction. Thank you. Is that the heating that was turned off or the air conditioning was turned off? The first of the nations and his ultimate is going to be destruction, says Bilam. Bilam the prophet, the non-Jewish prophet. What's first of the nations about him and what's the ultimate? He was the first to attack the Jewish people. When the Jewish people came out of Egypt, there was an aura of being invulnerable around them. They were taken out. Pharaoh couldn't attack them. The Egyptian army tried and they drowned in the sea. The sea split for them. The Mon came down. Water was found. They're surviving in a desert. There was this aura around them of indestructibility. Amalek set out to disprove that aura. And it's very easy to disprove the aura of anybody. It's very easy to prick the balloon. Very easy to find the nothingness in anything. And that means the balance is quite delicate, because sometimes you can make something out of nothing, idolatry, and you have to prick the balloon. But when it's not a nothing, when it's something, it's sometimes important to create and to maintain that aura. Every human being has an aura about them. Very easy to destroy that aura. Sometimes we destroy it ourselves, we don't need any help, and sometimes other people destroy it for us. And once a human being's aura has been destroyed, sometimes very difficult for him to recover that. The Jewish people had an aura of indestructibility, a deserved one. They are indestructible. The fact is, we're still around. But indestructible means you can't hurt, doesn't mean that you cannot hurt us. Indestructible doesn't mean that you cannot kill some of our old people and our children. Indestructible doesn't mean that you might not win a battle now and again against us. It means that in the eternal time frame, you can't destroy us. Amalek was out to destroy the aura. They're nothing special. They're no different to any other nation. One can battle them. If it weren't for Amalek, nobody would have started. If nobody would have started, just imagine. We would have had no Crusaders. We would have had no Spanish Inquisition. We would have had no Stalin. We would have had no Hitler. None of that would have happened. There would have been this absolute fear of touching the Jewish people. One man has to break that, that's all. Break the magic. Destroy the spell. And you can't really rebuild a spell again. A spell can be preserved. A spell can be nurtured. But a spell can be broken. And when the spell is broken, it's broken. There's nothing you can do. Amalek taught the world that the Jews are not indestructible, certainly not in short time frames. They're human like anybody else. They're vulnerable like anybody else. And if they get in your way, destroy them, or try and destroy them. That's the cynical nature of Amalek. They are nothing but an ordinary nation. They are nothing but ordinary human beings. They are nothing but a nation like other nations. That's what Amalek taught by being the first. And by being the first to fight us, Acharisa Adai Oved, says Bilam, at the end, when the world is brought to perfection, after Mashiach comes, and every nation finds its role, its contribution, its contributive purpose in life, and its relationship with the Jewish people, what will happen to Amalek? Where will it fit in? Where will the nation of Amalek fit in? It won't be capable of transformation because it's a nation of cynics. And therefore it has to be destroyed. The world cannot come to perfection until cynicism is destroyed. Cannot be educated, it cannot be modified. So what's the purpose in punishing them? Others learn. Yisro learns. But the Leitz himself doesn't learn a thing. When a teacher comes into a new class, one of the first things the teacher has to do is to identify the Leitz. Because in every classroom there's a Leitz. And to know that he will never change the Leitz. All he's got to do is make sure that the Leitz doesn't change everybody else. He's got to isolate the Leitz. He's just got to get the class against him. But he can't try and change the Leitz. He never will. You've got to be able to identify the Leitz. It's very dangerous to be operating in a society where you haven't identified the cynic. Where you're dealing with a cynic as if he's an ordinary human being. As if he's somebody capable of transformation. And therefore in leadership you can understand how destructive it is if the leader of a family or of an organization or of a society or a community is cynical. If a leader is cynical, he deprives the whole group from the possibility of transformation, from the possibility of evolution and of change. And so God says to Shaul, you have an opportunity. You have an opportunity to destroy Amalek. Why he more than other people? Amalek was descended from Esav. This goes right back to the time of Esav. The origins of cynicism was already early in the time of Esav. When Yaakov, Esav's twin brother, meets up with Esav, in order to establish peace with him, he brings gifts. He treats him with great courtesy. Esav's out to kill Yaakov. Yaakov uses diplomacy to try and shift Esav from his aggression into one of more acceptance. You see, one thing cynics are vulnerable to is flattery. They're very easily flattered. So if the cynic is getting in the way, don't try and fight him. You won't destroy him. Don't try and change him. Flatter him, and you'll cope with him very well. And that's what Yaakov did with Esav. And he told his children to do the same. His wives and his children bowed down to Esav, because he wasn't yet born. He was in his mother's tummy still. And that was Binyamin. Binyamin was the only son not yet born. And therefore he was the only one of Yaakov's children who never bowed down to Esav. Shaul was descended from Binyamin. Shaul is the man who has it within him to take on the force of cynicism and utterly destroy it. And utterly destroying the force of cynicism means every part of it. One can't even leave the animals. Even the animals are infected with that. The concept of pollution is not just a physiological concept. There can be moral pollution too. And just as the air can pollute the fish in the sea, and it can pollute the chickens and the cows and the sheep, so an immoral climate, particularly this one, impacts on the entire civilization, including its animals. And the only way this is going to be completely destroyed is by completely destroying this nation. And that's what Shaul is charged to do. Notice, in conclusion, that Shaul is not told, as the Malbim points out in verse 3, not to show... See, in Hebrew there are a lot of different words for this. You can tell a lot about a civilization by the synonyms that it has for particular concepts. So if you take Eskimos, I'm told, there are all sorts of different words for ice and snow. In English we have one or two words. They have a whole vocabulary. It's this kind of ice and that kind of ice. Bushmen in South Africa have many different words for water. The water that comes out of a tap is different for the word for water that flows in a river, is different for water that flows in a lake, because these things are terribly important to their survival. They live around, the Eskimo lives around snow, the Bushman lives around water. These things are terribly important. And the small discernment between what to us doesn't look all that much difference, to a Bushman is a very big difference if it's seawater or river water. It's not the same concept. One is drinkable, one isn't. Therefore, there are different terms for it, different words for it. In Hebrew, in English, we have for mercy, we have one word for mercy. Maybe one or two other words that are closely related. In Hebrew, there's a whole range of words. There's rachamim, there's chemla, there are many, there's chus, is a word. There are many different words for slight variations of mercy. The Malbim, a master of grammar and of Hebrew language, talks about chemla as demonstrating sympathy, and rachamim as feeling sympathy. God doesn't say to him, lo terachem, don't feel sympathy. You must feel sympathy. You're wiping out innocent people. It's a law. You've got to do it. It's a mitzvah. But that doesn't mean you do it without sympathy. I heard today, it sounds so difficult to believe, but I imagine it's true, that medical students, Roy, you might be able to help other doctors, are trained in medical school not to look at patients, but to look at disease. You're curing a disease, not a person. Don't get emotionally involved with a person. You're dealing with disease. You're dealing with science. You're a scientist. You're not a humanist. That's a frightening concept if it is so. One understands why it's so, but it's still frightening. God says, go and destroy the Amalekites, but don't disengage. Don't become hard-hearted. You should come home at night and cry and have nightmares about what you did, even though it was God's will. You see, that's the difference. When Muslim fanatics go out to on holy war, when they finish the battle, they have a party. There's no rachamim. There's no bad feeling about it afterwards. God says, I'm sorry to say you have to destroy these Amalekites, but I don't want you to do it with any kind of arrogance or celebration. This is a sad thing that you have to do. This is something you should be mourning about. No chemla. Don't demonstrate empathy. Be harsh in your action. But I have not forbidden rachamim. I have not forbidden you to feel mercy, to feel sympathy, that you must feel. We'll see next week as Shaul goes into battle how his emotions start playing and how they start impacting on his reasoning. The emotions of sympathy which God didn't ban, how they affect his actions, how they affect his judgment of the situations in which he finds himself, and what the impact of that is on the decisions he takes at that particular time, the decisions he makes, and the impact of those decisions not only on his life and on the life of their times, but on the life of our times as well, as we understand the conflicts that face this man in his first battle with the Amalekite nation.